All right. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the New Media Show. My name is Todd Cochran. Of course, I'm joined by my co-host, Mr. Rob Greenlee. Good morning, Rob. How are you?
Good morning, Todd. It's another fabulous day in Seattle. I know it's that time of the year. It's great here. I got my Surface 3 Pro Core i7 last night. It's exciting times.
So I'm surprised you didn't stay up all night playing with it, but I'm sitting.
I did virtually.
I'm sitting here heavily medicated. I put my back out Friday and spent some time with the doctor. He thought, "Oh, you got kidney stones," and he says, "Oh, maybe it's a aorta aneurysm." I'm like, "How do we go from back pain to aorta aneurysm?" So I'm not kidding you. I was in a CT machine and blood. I'm like, my back hurts. It's not my kidney. I know it's not some, you know, and he said, "Oh, I've seen this three times." So, of course, I'm retired military, so I was being seen at a military facility. So you can thank the taxpayer dollars for spending a huge amount of money unnecessarily when all I needed was some Flexeril and some painkills. That was it. That's all I needed. Yeah. And guess what I left with? Flexeril and some pain pills.
So. That's right. And a big bill, maybe? No.
Yeah, well,
was it all covered?
Uncle Sam paid for it. So, like
all
I said,
thanks
to the taxpayers.
All right.
Okay. So, anyway, we got a great guest on this morning, Mike Chaffee from the Adam Carolla Show. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hey now. Yeah. Thanks for having me, man. It's a quite the opposite of Seattle. Here in Pasadena, it's muggy and miserable in the summer. But otherwise, you know, it's a nice summer. It's a little slower than it's been work-wise all year. And just enjoying talking podcasting.
Well, you know, we try to cover the full gambit here, and we're going to definitely do that today. But for those of you that don't know, Mike is the CTO and also the co-founder of Adam Carolla Show. And that's a pretty cool claim to fame. That goes good on the old resume, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. You know what? I feel like those titles may be a bit grandiose. We're a small company. We're not the biggest company in the world. I don't know that we have a ton of chief officers, but CTO is one that I guess a lot of companies, if you're in the podcasting space, are going to need to talk to. So that's the one that seems to make the most sense. And, you know, I was lucky enough to help start the podcast with Adam. So it's been good. I agree. I think it's a great thing on the resume, and it's been a fun bit of my career.
You know what? We really are chief cat herders. That's what we really are.
Bug fixers is what we are.
Yeah.
We're constantly keeping things working. Hey, Mike, why don't you tell us, kind of how you got started with the Adam Carolla Show? I know it goes back into the, you know, his radio days too, but why don't you talk about kind of that transition and what you guys went through back then? I know we talked a lot back in 2009 when I got you on the Zoom platform and was kind of talking with you about that time. Why don't you share a little bit of history of that show?
Sure, happy to. Yeah, it's a fun transition. So I'm a radio guy. That's how I started my career. And I'm just a nerd because, you know, I got my TRS-80 when I was like a 5-year-old. So between those two things, I slowly became more of a digital and social liaison at the Adam Carolla Morning Show, which replaced Howard Stern on terrestrial radio. Started my career there, became an associate producer, and when CBS said, "Hey, listen, this talk format's not really working anymore. We're going to flip this into a basically, I would say iPod, but because Rob's here, a Zune player with some commercials mixed in." Adam said, "Well, listen, I've got a good fan base. They've always listened to me online. So might as well keep this going and start a podcast." So he and I, literally the Sunday night after KLSX it flipped formats and put Adam off the air on terrestrial radio, we started the podcast that Sunday night. So just a couple days later. I'd known podcasting, I'd listened to podcasting, I'd never done it, so it was a crash course in RSS and XML and CDNs, and I knew a little bit of some of that stuff, again, being a geek by trade, I suppose. And, you know, through blood, sweat, and tears, we made it work, and there were some hiccups here and there, but overall it's been a very successful show. And yeah, people like Rob, a lot of people just helping with advice and thoughts, and here's how you get it out, and here's how you start. It was the community really helped out very early on in helping me get educated and teaching me some of the finer points of some of the larger podcasts in the world.
You know, it's interesting how small ideas turn into these big monsters, because did you guys really think that, you know, taking that step would result in what it is today, or was it fully expected?
I don't know how much Adam thought it would be the business it is today, which is probably what you're thinking of more than anything. But to a good way to illustrate what my thought process was at that time, I was preparing for 5,000 to 10,000 downloads. So, you know, in terms of looking at CDNs and streaming and costs and bandwidth and all that. And I was quickly blown away by the amount of bandwidth I had to actually start preparing for. So I think we thought it was just going to be something temporary. At least I did. But it turned out to be a very robust business and a real thing.
Well, so Mike, didn't he think that he was going to probably get another radio gig, or was he pretty much burned on that? I know he was under a contract for a while after he ended the show, and he couldn't have sponsors on his show, right? Because of his contract, I think it was it Viacom, I think?
CBS, yeah. Same difference.
CBS, okay.
Yeah. So he did have a contract, and I wouldn't – he didn't give me a huge amount of insight into what the next 2 years looked like for him career-wise in terms of radio and podcasting. I don't know if his intention was, hey, this is going to be a stopgap for just a little while until this contract – and you're right, there was some sort of contract. I don't know the exact details. He was under contract for a few more months ultimately, but that didn't cover online. So we went online, considered it promotional. I don't know if we were prohibited from doing advertising or if we were just trying to build a good product for the listeners before we delved into that. But ultimately, we did hold off on advertising for a few months. And Adam, the one thing I will say about Adam, and this is an insight he's given me personally, but I feel like anyone who's listened to him has learned this, is that I think he really enjoys talking on the radio. He likes having a platform. He likes being entertaining on that platform. And it's not too much of a chore for him, even though he'll talk about coming in and the work it is. So I think that gave him his platform where he can do those things and maybe look at other things in his career, whether it's a TV show, movie, and all those things are happening. I can't say that's exactly what went through his head, but my guess was, well, this is great. Let me keep doing this, and let me also work on my other side projects. It sort of affords me the ability to do all that stuff.
So is the big takeaway, you think, after your experience with, you know, with Adam making this transition, that you need to be kind of in multiple mediums in order to really build a big show? I mean, that's a little bit been my experience with, you know, with the own show that I built over the years, is that you really have to get into a lot of different places and reach an audience, you know, live events and doing other, you know, I mean, like he does TV shows. Obviously I never did TV shows, but getting on other mediums to let people know about the podcast, right?
Yeah. You make a great point, and Adam's been that guy since before he was into podcasting. Of if there's a small market radio station in Iowa that wants to talk to me, I'm ready to talk to them, because why not? It's not too much time. If I create a few more fans for life, then it's worthwhile. It was worth that 10-15 minutes. So he's always been that guy, and I think you're right, and I think your typical podcaster, and there's lots of tiers. I think there's no black and white here. But I think, and I wouldn't say TV personalities, I think the marketing opportunities presented to certain larger personalities like an Adam or Chris Hardwick or guys like that affords them the ability to gain more listeners and teach them how to podcast and all that stuff. I still see a lot of people who aren't those big TV-type guys who are doing really, really well. I think there are it's probably fair to say there's a couple tiers of audiences of podcasting. I think Adam is towards the top of that. I think a lot of the guys in that group are mostly kind of the more well-known guys. But I think a lot of guys who have been podcasters since day one and not much else still can do pretty well. But I think you're right. The TV guys are set up for success is the best way to put it.
You know, it's something I've watched for a long, long time is really this stack, you know, on how it breaks down and where the tiers are. And I'd almost call it, you know, four tiers. It'd be almost like the Adam Carolla level. And my God, I wish everyone was at that level, you know, because, you know, we'd be changing the world completely. But, and we are, but it would happen much faster. Then you've got this next tier that is, I guess for a better word, probably, you know, in the 100,000 audience members. And then maybe the third tier is, maybe they're using five tiers, 50K or so. But there's a big difference between the folks that are at the, let's say, 3,000 to 5,000 level from an audience standpoint to the 50 to the 100, and then, of course, beyond that for where Adam's at. And you just see different things happening in those shows. And I've just, it always puzzles me, too. So, you know, there's folks that are on that lower tier that have fantastic content, are great communicators, you know, have great chops, and yet they're not making big inroads. And you would think over time that they would increase those numbers, but oftentimes they don't. They kind of just hover there, and it takes some sort of an event to push them, yep. You know, and it's either they got attention on some article or they got some national press, or it's just something, you know, some event. But it's often very hard for folks to, you know, and they will build over time, but what do you think these, smaller shows should do? Especially, you know, let's just talk to the guys that are really good, but are not progressing. I guess that's the better word.
And by the way, I feel uniquely suited to talk about this. Not that I'm good at any of this, but besides my experience at Carolla, I had my own podcast for a while with a very close friend and another guy in the community, Mark Chambers, called Low Budget FM, and we had that exact same problem. I'm certainly biased, but I thought it was a funny show, and a few others did as well. But we were at that bottom tier. We were at like the 2,000 to 5,000 listeners, and we made the jump. And I'm kind of surprised we did, because I'm not a celebrity. Mark's not a celebrity. We're just these sort of geeky guys who are having a fun time on a podcast. And we made this jump to about like 20, 25,000 listeners on our small little fun show. And I feel like the reason for that, I think you're right. One, you need an event to really have stuff like that happen. And the event for us may not have been a content event. It was more of a, hey, let's reach out to all the new platforms. Stitchers of the world, the Spreecast, the literally everyone, and little by little, that did fracture our audience. You know, they were in all these different places, but at the end of the day, they ended up coming back home to our main podcast, to our main source of listening via the website, via our CDN, and it was just, and maybe Mark and I were well suited to talk to the heads of those companies and the key decision makers at those companies that may have helped out Low Budget FM, but maybe not. Maybe if any other podcast reached out and sort of talked to every company out there, you might have this ability to reach a new audience that's untapped for your show. And so that's what helped us. I don't know that it would work for every podcast, and I think major media events is probably the better way to do it. I can also, you know, and this may be a better thing for our panel at some point. I can also talk about plans and stuff we did at the show, Low Budget FM, where instead of taking advertising dollars and putting it in our pocket, we used it immediately for more media for the show and ultimately for the advertiser. So we were always trying to think out and grow the show.
Yeah, this show's been the same. I always reinvest a portion of the advertising money right back into the show instead of my pocket. Yep. You know, and... Go ahead, Mike. Go ahead, Rob.
I was just going to ask Mike about social media and podcasting, and if I'm a little bit on the fence about really how successful building an audience for podcasts are in social media. I But I'd love to get your guys' comment on that. And I think, you know, is there some strategies that are more successful? I know I've been a little frustrated that that Facebook hasn't had the ability to have like embedded players and that kind of stuff. They're kind of limiting that ability today. They actually used to have it. Just, you know, let's talk about social media a little bit. And I think, you know, as Facebook grows and Twitter grows, and you know, it feels like that there's an opportunity there to grow listenership of podcasting. But is that really, you think, where the growth is going to come from in building an audience in podcasting? What do you guys think?
You sort of speak to one of my day jobs, really. My day job is about social media for other people. The opportunity is going to be big. And I know that podcasting, a lot of us talk on Google Plus. I actually like Google Plus, even though that's not a lot of people in my position would say that. I think there's an opportunity there for a lot of brands. I don't know how to approach social and podcasting. And I say that, you know, we have our plans, we have our operations for Corolla, and we do a lot of stuff, but I think you're right. You know, I think just thinking about it anecdotally of how either of you guys might flick through Twitter and you don't consume anything. You just read it really quick. You're not going to stop and listen to a podcast via Twitter. So how do you use Twitter for anything other than brand awareness? Well, that's what you do. You raise brand awareness for the Adam Carolla Show or Carolla Digital. I think Facebook is a tougher thing to plan around because you want brand awareness, but you want those tangible things that you just mentioned, like a player in line in your Facebook feed or something like that. And I think those products will come. I can't say that with a huge amount of confidence, but I feel like Facebook will have more good for podcasters at the end of the day, and Google Plus. I don't mean to limit it to Facebook. But I think those things will become more and more important. And I think, I don't know, I think so many people are so used to hearing their music and sharing music, and it's become more of a social thing to say, hey, listen to this 2-minute song instead of this 40-minute podcast. That's sort of one of the things podcasting might have to work around, which is a big hill to climb, I think.
You know, you said something earlier, you know, about what it took to build your guys' personal show and, you know, reaching out to those groups. And I found that most of, you know, the Stitchers and even Apple now are starting to become more receptive to having, you know, if nothing else, a short conversation or an email exchange with you. And I think they're more inclined to talk to groups instead of individuals. So, you know, if you're part of a group of shows, I think they have a tendency to talk to you more, and if you have a central person that can speak for the group, then they, you know, they're looking for submissions as well. You know, having talked to the Apple folks a couple of weeks ago, they're like, yep, why not, you know, this channel, why don't you send us over anything special happening in any of those shows, or especially, you know, just, you know, call some stuff out, because they're having challenges. You know, you look at the inventory that are on those directories, they're having challenges in, you know, what to pick for a top pick or what to feature. You know, there are all these so-called formulas out there and how you get in a certain list. There's really no formula. It's communications and sometimes luck. So if you don't communicate with those groups and talk to them and tell them, hey, there's a show that's going to reach its 100th episode, or, you know, they did something really cool with this guy. And you got to be timely. You just say, you know, you have to let them know in advance so that they can plan and get you in the stack. And I think that can get people exposure. But at the same time, you can't be barraging them every week. You have to, you know, you have to be nice about it. And I think what would happen is some individuals and people that are listening to this show need to understand that these people's times are very valuable. So you send them something when something very specific and very, I guess for better words, off the charts going to happen, not just episode 22.
And I couldn't agree with that more. And I think people know this in the back of their heads because it's how every website out there works. Huffington Post takes emails from anybody and everybody about content that they need. Ultimately, all these platforms, I single out one blog, but whether it's a blog, whether it's a platform, whether it's a YouTube, they're trying to curate content, and they don't know the entire universe of content. No one can. That's nearly impossible. So you're right. They need a human element to sort of say, hey, here's some good stuff. Maybe you should use this. Maybe it can be helpful to you. And ultimately, hopefully, all these podcasts can be helpful, or your content, your podcast can be helpful to this website, this platform. And it's creating that relationship or even workflow where you're exactly right. You're not wasting somebody's time. You're signaling out good stuff that can be useful to them. And making it actually useful to them, plugging content in on their platform or website where they really need to put some in and engaging their audience in whatever way or whatever goal they need to have. That it's important for podcasting. It's also important whether, you know, you're a YouTube star, you're writing your own personal blog. It's the same thing you see everywhere, but it's a little bit of a harder nut to crack with podcasting than probably video or blogs, certainly blogs.
The chat room is definitely alive, so Rob, I'll let you respond to one of these. But Daniel says, I think the key to making social work with podcasting is pointing to the right platform. So I don't know 100% because Dan or go on, and Rob, basically he refers to Snooki, which is with you guys at Podcast One. He says Snooki didn't do well in iTunes because they weren't pointing to the right platform. Of course, you asking, what do you mean by right platform? Daniel said, wasn't Snooki pointing people directly to the audio file, not even the website with subscription links?
Well, I would have to say that's not exactly accurate. I mean, we were very, very traditional in how we distributed the Snooki podcast. It is true that Snooki's podcast has not performed quite as well as we had expected in iTunes very specifically, but I think the bigger thing going on with Snooki was that she was building a huge audience for her show off of iTunes, not on iTunes. And I think it also speaks to a bigger trend that's happening in the podcasting space, which means that you can build an audience on right now and not have to be so dependent on iTunes. There's more podcast catchers out there. There's a lot of new people that are starting to listen to audio off of websites, off of, you know, streaming players, or I mean, even like he points out, actually downloading the episode. And I think it gets back, you know, to what may be happening is this podcasting is on-demand audio, right? And as we kind of move into different genres of content that maybe appeal to different audiences, there may be different use cases for different genres of content, and it may not all be centered around iTunes. And I think that's the bigger message of what I've seen with some of the shows that we've launched here recently that are kind of maybe don't necessarily appeal to typical Apple users. And I think I think that's a good trend. I think that's a good thing. I mean, if we can get into content that is acceptable in other playback environments online, I think that's fantastic. And as we get more radio shows and more kind of broadcast people involved in the space, I think it elevates the whole space. And that's a much bigger conversation. But you know, Podcast One is kind of sitting in the convergence of, you know, we're trying to plow into new genres of content. We're trying to try a lot of different things. We work very closely with the Snooki team to strategize in their social platforms, and from what we've seen is great success with going directly to her fan base, and we're talking millions of people that follow her. So anyway, it's a complicated story on what's happening with that show, but I don't think being on a different platform is really the answer, though. Like we talked about earlier, the whole Facebook challenge is definitely, you know, holding that show back. Getting a player in Facebook would be a big boom because she's got 12 million followers on Facebook.
You know, Rob, and that's been the status with my show for many years, is I have not been dependent on iTunes for a lot of my audience, you know, because, you know, but there's a reason for that too. People come to my website every day for the content, and with 12,000 articles on the website, I got incredible Google juice. You know, and Google drives 20,000-25,000 hits a day just in search results. So invariably, that will trickle into people listening to the show. And the only way you do that is by growing your brand, your base. I mean, I've been preaching this for forever, yet podcasters most refuse to do any additional content beyond their show. And if you're not going to blog, you need to be doing something else somewhere else. You're doing some additional stuff to drive traffic. And I'm a firm believer in this, you know, having a complete package for people. Some people just consume content. That's great. That's maybe what's good for people landing on a network site. There's lots of fresh content every day. But, you know, it's, you know, if they're coming to your brand, they want to come and they want something to see. And I want them to come to the website every day.
Yeah. And Daniel also talks about, you know, subscription links. And I think it's, I mean, I think that's a fair point. I think we certainly could have done a better job of making available off of the Snooki site links to iTunes to add to their subscription list. And we focused, or that team focused on just putting an embedded player in there in a blog post. And I'm working with the Snooki team right now to get a dedicated podcast page that would have all the episodes listed on their particular website. It's the same kind of thing that we've done for the Dan Patrick Show. And here more recently, the Clark Howard Show, which is a huge radio show. If you go to their sites, you can get a list of all the episodes coming off of Podcast One right off of their own website. So, you know, but I 100% agree. Putting in their subscription links could make a greater connection with iTunes. Though we did have a major feature in iTunes this past week for the Snooki podcast, finally. So we didn't really have a big promotional push in iTunes until just this past week, and I think she's doing better in iTunes now.
You know, and with the update of Windows 8.1, if you don't have an RSS feed on your website, you're screwed. You're not going to get found on Windows 8.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, as soon as people update to Windows 8.1, the Zune Marketplace is gone, and if Microsoft and the Bing search platform can't find your RSS feed, you're not getting that Windows users. Now, granted, I'm not going to talk about the percentages. We know what it is, but none of us can handle any hit. I don't want a 1% loss or 2% or 5% loss in my audience. Yeah. You know, that's revenue. And for not everyone worries about revenue, but I got a family to feed, you know, so I do worry about revenue.
Yep. And the one thing I throw out there, and you know, I deal with this at all my jobs, is it's sort of the difference between leasing a workspace and maybe even borrowing is a better way to think of it, borrowing someone's audience and workspace and all that versus owning your own website and owning your own. You're at the mercy of all these platforms.
Yeah.
Which, you know, they bring a lot of good. I don't mean to make this sound entirely negative, but one day it may not meet the business goal for whatever huge company it's a part of, and that will entirely go away. The more you can own your audience on platforms and destinations that you truly own and truly control, the better it is for you. And by the way, that's besides future-proofing your show and your audience. I think across the board, you'd see higher CPMs, you'd see higher engagement. You'd create real, as the radio industry at least used to say when I worked there, P1 listeners, people that are truly engaged in your show and really consume it wholeheartedly versus stumbling into it.
Yeah, and the guys that stumble in, you know, you've got a couple of minutes to catch them. So, you know, if you, and it's just like a website, if they stay for more than two or three episodes and you consider yourself lucky that they're now probably going to subscribe and at least periodically listen to you or build you into their schedule and listen to it on a regular basis. So, you know, we don't even need to get into the consistency discussion because we all then harp that to death forever. So when it comes to, you know, Adam's over on his site, he's got a pretty grueling schedule, but I know you guys often record more than one episode at a time. You know, what's the production schedule like over there?
In a word, hectic. It's been very hectic. Adam's gotten very good at streamlining, and all the staff has the production of those shows. But you're right. We'd like, you know, on an average week, and you know, I'll speak to his main show, not all the other shows he's a part of, the Adam Carolla show, but he's a part of, and I think a lot of listeners know this or viewers, the Adam and Drew show, Carcast, all these other podcasts that he still plays a part in. But in a perfect world, if he didn't have everything else going on, even when he does have some of these things going on, we try our best to do 5 shows a week, 5 recordings, basically the day of. Lately, he's had a lot of spinning plates, so that's become a little more difficult. So sometimes we'll grab a show whenever we can. And it's not the best thing because we do try to truly emulate our radio days of if you're having a radio show, it's a brand new show that morning. We'd like to create new content every day, but just due to his hectic schedule, sometimes that doesn't happen. But we don't stray off that mark a ton. We're still pretty close. It's typically, you know, at its worst, we're still creating 3 new shows a day, and we're not banking shows for more than a couple of days at most. So it's usually just doubling up a recording with a couple of podcasts and saving that for a day, if and when needed, is probably the best way to think of it.
You know, I was talking with a gentleman yesterday that is here in Hawaii, and I was sharing with him how the AfterBuzz folks do 80 shows a week and the absolute insanity that must be. And I still marvel at that after talking last week with them over there. And, you know, 3's a lot, but can you just, can you even just wrap your mind around doing 80? I just, to me, that sounds like chaos, but
well, hopefully it's organized chaos.
Yeah, it has to be organized chaos.
Yeah.
So, you know, 3's tough, but my God, 80. So, and then of course, with the, you know, how does you guys' production workflow then? Are you guys pretty much live to, you know, I don't want to say this like live to tape, but live to digital and chop, chop and publish, or how much post-editing goes on with the programming?
No, you're exactly right. And that's, you know, I think some people overthink that or underthink it, but it's truly by design for Adam. I think he, if it's not an element in the show, he doesn't want to mix it in via post. And if it's something that needs to be done via post, hopefully it's done before the show and rolled in. I think he likes that radio show element of let it fly. And that's pretty much what we do. It's, you know, I know what you mean. In this digital world, it's hard not to say things like live to tape, but I'm used to that phrase. it is pretty much live to tape. There are certainly no content edits, and there's nothing more than trimming something for time is the most I would say on a typical day. So it is record the show, do the typical stuff that every podcaster, you know, probably knows all too well. Edit the MP3 tags, make sure your MP3 file is named correctly, just tiny stuff like that, add the artwork, all that business, and then do our business on the CMS to make it go out to the public.
You know, and it's you know, what's beautiful about that is, you know, I remember being at NAB a couple of years ago, and we were really pushing the set-top box channels that we build for companies. And this guy come up to me, says, "Oh, I'm a film producer, and you know, I've got a great deal for you. We will produce a series of shows for you for $20,000 an episode." And you know, I laughed at the guy, and I said, "My production cost on a per episode basis, if I include my time and an hourly wage for my time, it's probably a couple hundred bucks." And the guy just looks at me like I was from Mars, and it made me feel so good because I think in his mind, his brain exploded because he's thinking, "I'm done. I'm out of a job. I'm screwed." And that's really probably the biggest thing for all of us is, you know, there's obviously production costs no matter what, but it's nowhere, you know, we've been able to completely eliminate just this huge burden to entry. And that's what's so fantastic about this space.
Hey, Mike, I wanted to ask you about Adam from a talent perspective and from a skill perspective. I think a lot of podcasters can really learn from him on how to engage an audience and build a fan base. Are there things, I mean, you've been with him a long time and probably really understand his mental strategy around that. Is there any way you could share some of the things that you've seen him kind of go through and strategize about in how he presents himself and how he puts his show together that actually connects with people? You know, I know a big struggle that we have with trying to bring in new talent is that rare ability to connect on a show with an audience in a genuine and authentic way that builds rabid fan bases that will you know, buy a product or you know, tweet, you know, about your show at just the mention of it in a program. Is there any way you can run through some of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one element is kind of what I was just speaking to. It is Adam doesn't chop things up in post. What you hear in the show is really what he was saying in the show. He's not editing himself. He's not editing himself in post. He's truly letting it fly. He's just letting it go out there. That's one thing. So I think that's important. I think that means a lot. You know, I think people know whether they're very conscious of it or it just rubs them the wrong way, or and that may be overstating it. I think people know when you are heavily editing a piece, and I think that takes a human element out of it. I think it's a different thing. If it was a bunch of 3-minute segments that Adam spent 10 minutes making, I think that would be a very different feeling show than Adam talking and doing his hour-long podcast or hour and a half and pretty much letting it fly. So I think you're getting a sense of what Adam's really about when something like that happens. I think another important thing is his fan base has been pretty consistent across the board. I think since the Loveline days and the Adam Carolla morning show and the podcast, the listener tends to be pretty consistent, you know, 10, 12, 15 years later with what it first was. I think they're interested in hearing comedy. I think they're interested in hearing Adam's takes on politics, all that stuff. So I think that's a huge part of it. And three, and you can see this more so with podcasting now, but you can also see it with his bosses in the radio days. I think Adam will say whatever is on his mind. He will not self-edit, especially if he thinks it's interesting or if it's rubbing him the wrong way or if it's, you know, often he talks about ranting and he does his rants. I think that's an important thing. I think a lot of people won't go ahead and do that, won't talk freely as he will about whatever subject it is that's affecting his life. I think that might be the number one thing for him is not self-editing in his head, not actually editing the show at all, you know, in post. I think those elements are important to what has made him succeed.
You know, but is it, I mean, his humor is probably, you think, the connecting glue, you think that holds that together and how.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean the comedy is the most accessible thing. Like the fact that he is, and by the way, it's true. If any of you guys are ever with him, you know, not when he's not doing a show, he really is that funny just nonstop. It never ends with him. He's just one of the quickest wits around, and everyone can enjoy that. I think that's one of the most accessible things in the world. That, you know, everyone likes having a laugh. Everyone likes a quick wit. And so that leads into these other things that he's great at. So I think it starts with that. I think that's not, and you're exactly right. And I probably didn't talk to that enough of he's this incredible wit and he's very good at that. And everyone enjoys that. And that leads to these other things.
You know, you said something a few seconds ago that really kind of like, bam, hit me in the face. And it's self-editing. And I find myself, boy, I'm guilty of it. I've done it a few, you know, I've done it a number of times. And sometimes It's because
I think you have to be careful with that kind of stuff. I mean, some people can get away with it and some people can't, I think.
Well, it's some of it's for self-preservation in protecting. Well, there's been some things I haven't been able to talk about. Maybe it's a good segue. You know, there's been some stuff that I have been very reluctant to talk deeply about and really share my gut. And Adam has been able to kind of voice some of our opinions. But, you know, he's been able to speak for the community, and this is in response to the patent situation. And what'd you say, Mike?
It's been interesting, and I can't speak a ton on this issue. And I think with dancing around it, everyone knows, you know, the patent troll stuff is ultimately right. what you're speaking to. And Adam's been very vocal, and he doesn't like being bullied ultimately.
Yeah.
And he doesn't like what he doesn't like. And he'll be vocal about that, and he's not worried about the consequences, and especially if he thinks that there are no real consequences, if it's sort of a BS process. So I've seen it with him and for other things across the board, where a lot of people and where there would be real risks for people like you and me, and there still are very real risks for Adam, you know, he wants to do the right thing. Like, and that means a very tough battle at the end of the day. But it with real consequences to him and the bottom line and all that stuff. But he's exactly what, you know, it self-editing is a good way to put it. He doesn't self-edit.
And I think, you know, while we won't be able to talk a lot about that situation, everyone's listening knows, we know that Adams raised a significant amount of money via a legal defense fund. And folks can find that at fundanything.com, I believe. Just search for Adam Carolla on Fund Anything. And the actual page, I was going to bring that up and show it to everyone. It's $462,000 he's raised for that legal defense fund. And, of course, the EFF is also in this battle at the same time, where people have contributed money. But, you know, there was a couple of things that happened. You know, the folks that were pursuing this went after the, you know, the donor list at EFF. And that, to me, was pretty surprising. And the court did rule against them on that, which was good. But I guess this is going to come to a head here pretty soon. I saw that the trial's due to start soon. And, of course, there's been stuff in the press recently as well that's been interesting to read. But, you know, and for those of you that want us to get into this, we can't.
Nope.
Okay. So, you know, after everything's done and wrapped up, there's probably going to be a lot of commentary about it. But everyone has to understand.
I'll say this. I can't wait for the day when I can talk about it freely. it's been a personal drain on me at times, but when the day comes when I can talk about it freely, I will certainly do so.
Go ahead, Rob.
Thought I was just going to say, Podcast One is going to start a campaign to raise funds to support the Adam Carolla effort too. So we're gonna be starting that next week. So you know, things aren't gonna slow down on that front until we get that patent kind of disallowed. And I think we need to look at it from a two-pronged kind of approach. You know, you've got this case, you know, that involves Carolla and a few other big companies out there, big media companies, and then there's the Electronic Frontier Foundation's effort to kind of kill the patent's relevancy. And so there's kind of two pieces of this. And I think we all as a community need to not back off or anything. We need to keep pushing. So.
And there's a viewer in the chat room, interesting, that saying, if Adam loses the counterclaim, podcasters will have to pay. And that's not necessarily 100% true. The trial is in September, and there's nothing confidential about the current proceedings. It's true. All the court filings are public domain. You can review them, and so you know, there's really nothing besides the only thing that is confidential is the discovery stuff that hasn't come out in the trial. And once the trial happens, and there will be You know, obviously the testimony will be transcribed and be available for people to read. And, you know, that, you know, that, Mike, you know, that opens up a whole another thing. It just really, it's really raising your skirt. And, and, you know, for a better word, you know, the marvels will fall where they may. But it is going to be an interesting time to watch what happens in September.
Yep.
Yes.
So those of you out there chomping for more information, it's going to come in mass quantities, I'm sure, here soon. Okay, but yeah, so yeah, that's self-editing, you know, going back, that's, you know, many of us are self-editing and in refraining from saying stuff. And sometimes on, you know, depending on your situation, maybe a lawyer has advised you to self-edit or a, you know, there's something you personally you want to say that a little bird in the back of your brain says, shut up, don't say that, stupid. And sometimes you should listen to yourself. Maybe sometimes you shouldn't. There's, you know, there's sometimes I say stuff on my own show that I'm like, oh, why did I say that? You know? And I think we all do that from time to time. But it's nice to be in a position where you don't have to self-edit.
It's not, I will say that besides being in that position, it's great to work for the guy who's not self-editing. It feels good. It feels good to work for a guy who's fighting the good fight and saying what's on his mind. It's a liberating. Even though I'm not nearly as prone to do it as he is, it's a good feeling to work for that guy.
Yeah, I think if you're at that kind of level where you work for yourself, you have your own company, your whole job is to pontificate on things like he does, I think you're a lot freer. But if you're working for a company or you're kind of, you know, inside stuff that shouldn't be shared, it makes it a little bit tougher to be as transparent and open like that. But also I wanted to mention too here, just this past week, the Corolla Digital Network launched the Jesse Ventura show, which I thought was really, really interesting. Speaking of a show that's a little controversial and talks about tough issues, could you talk about that show a little bit, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit's a good way of phrasing it. We've become good at, and I don't mean for self-editing reasons. I mean, it's become part and parcel for us to add shows that make sense to add, basically.
Right.
And
right.
It's become such a process that it's pretty well handled. And, you know, we deal with people like Podcast One, who's our CMS and overall podcast delivery guys. We set it up with you. We know the rigors of setting it up on other platforms and putting it out there and marketing it. And we advise his team on doing the right things to make it a successful start to the podcast. But I also try to tell everyone, listen, it's not this day. It's not this week. Think about the launch as the next 2, 3, 4 weeks. Don't consider it this one day. Don't get super excited or super bummed out by the numbers in this one day. Give it some time. This is about building something. It's not about getting something the first day.
And I think that's a big mistake most average podcasters make too. And that's why we see this, continue to see this high failure rate, is folks say, oh my God, after 5 episodes, no one's listening. And I'm like, no one knows you.
takes time to get the, you know, get the word out too.
Yeah.
I mean, it just doesn't happen overnight.
Absolutely.
Even for big podcasters, even for decent celebrities, like just because you are a big celebrity and you have a huge audience, it may take a few days for people to get into the listening habits and defining your feed, into having the time to listen and working it into their daily or weekly or whatever it is routine. So I think this is good across the board. I think it's important to think about expectations in a meaningful way and hey, it's not so important this first day, but how many listeners are you going to get after a month or after a year, and how does it grow? What's the trajectory is maybe the better way of thinking of things.
But Mike, there is an expectation specifically out of Hollywood, that you're going to make it big fast. And that's the big, that's the thing that I've seen, is that the expectations are, you know, it's like what we see with TV shows, right? The studios will launch a show, and if it's not successful in the first 3 episodes, they're already talking about canceling it, you know? And I think I do see a little bit of that going on down there. That's approach. So as you look at big celebrities and bigger media companies get involved in podcasting, they tend to think it's going to happen fast. And things will get killed off pretty fast, you know. I kind of push back on that, but that is a little bit of a kind of a culture that I think is going to change, but that's kind of there's a certain amount of attitude around that.
And
go ahead, Todd.
No, go ahead, Mike.
I think that's important for you and me, Rob, because I think that's part of the reasons we have our jobs and our careers. It's like, hey, this is how these things work. It's not going to be an instant thing. I think it's really tempering that thought across a huge subset of people. I think that's important for us.
Yep. And I'm kind of on the, I guess I wouldn't say other end of the spectrum, but I'm working with a lot of non-celebrities. And, you know, I tell these folks, hey, this is at least a 2-year process. You know, don't give up in week 3. You know, you need to looking at this and where we're going to be in 2 years and planning for 5. And anyone that I bring on as part of my, you know, I'm building a few shows at Geek News Central is I'm telling these guys. And I'm taking folks that are brand new out of the starting block. No one knows them from Adam. I'm saying, you know, this is a couple year process to really get ramped up and rolling. We're going to help. We're going to try to push traffic your way. But at the same time, people need to understand they need to get out there, work their community, and do the things that they need to do to promote the show, because it ultimately comes back to the content. But at the same time, people need to have a realistic expectation on the time involved and the work that's going to be needed to done to get things where they need to be. So, you know, and I think it's, you know, Rob, you guys talking about, you know, a celebrity where they expect these instant returns. I can understand where that comes from, too, because these guys already have, many of them have 1 million followers. If they can't engage, you know, 20, 30, 50,000 of them to tune in, maybe they're really not fans. Maybe they're just, I'm watching this guy to see where he goes next instead of being engaged.
Yeah, I can't always tell, you know, you can't really tell how engaged a celebrity's fan base is really until you kind of test it. But also, I think different celebrities have different talents, right? And I've seen this a little bit, too, where connecting with people over an audio program is a very specialized talent, and not every celebrity that even has a big following can actually be successful at it. And that gets back to my earlier question of Mike's about kind of Adam's kind of unique talent in that way. That not every celebrity, just because you're a celebrity doesn't mean that you're going to be able to be successful at connecting with an audience over an audio program or a podcast. And I think that, you know, it's hard to tell that sometimes. And I think there's a skill there that can be developed over time that will be, you know, and I've seen a few shows at Podcast One where we're started out really slow, you know, we're lacking some focus, and over time they started to develop their voice and their ability to communicate value to their audience and to be funny and to be kind of engaging with them. And then all of a sudden the show just takes off, you know, it finally finds its groove and gets there.
Yeah, I don't think we can discount what Mike said something earlier as well. You know, Adam is Adam.
Yeah.
Adam's not different off camera than on camera.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the key. You know, that's a big key of it, you know, because, you know, oftentimes I'll meet someone that's a podcaster and be like, oh, who are you? You know, and I think that that is it's a big part of it, is just being yourself. Whether positive or negatively, be yourself.
I totally agree, and there's room for people to have these characters or personas or however you would phrase it. But besides Adam being Adam, he's also a battle-tested Adam. He started in radio many years ago, learning through, you know, daily work of what works for him and what works for the audience and what people enjoy and how he handles it. He's been doing radio, he's been doing this type of thing longer than most people have even known about podcasting. So he's got a unique advantage in that he's mastered this medium, and he's just delivering it in a different way.
You know, Rob, if you think back to where you were when you started doing content and where you are now, you probably shudder at some of that early content.
Yeah, I mean, it's a completely different attitude that I have now towards everything, too. I mean, I tried to reboot my old show that I used to do. And it's like, you know, I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't get my head back into that same space. And it felt like, you know, I was going backwards, not going forwards. So it's why, you know, I'm doing this show now and not really doing my own show anymore, is because I'm just my standards are so high that I just don't have time to actually do it. But I did learn a lot from doing my own show and went through all those struggles and things like that. And realize now, you know, working with, you know, some of the talent that I'm working with now is that, you know, I don't have that talent, honestly. And I did have some success with my own show, just, you know, really for a lot of reasons, you know, around scarcity. You know, the topics that I was talking about were new and unique at the time. And I was able to pull off a pretty aggressive syndication strategy that got my show in front of a lot of people. And I got a lot of attention at the time for it in other mediums too, you know, newspapers and online publications that would say, you know, this is a show to go listen to if you want to learn about the web and the internet back in the early days. I don't know that I'll ever go back to really doing my own radio show again, just because I just can't get my, you know, I just can't dedicate that much time to it, and I can't get my mindset focused on producing content at that level again. It was such an all-encompassing thing for me to do at the time. But I wanted to kind of move on a little bit and talk a little bit about what happened with Swell this past week. I don't know if you guys followed that.
I did, but I have one last question for Mike on the four-minute... So, you know, what I'm seeing, Mike, is it must be interview month. I've been doing a lot of interviews. Sure. And all the interviews that I've been having lately have been pretty, except for one, have been pretty scripted. And it kind of drives me crazy, these scripted interviews. It's a set number of questions, and it, I almost feel like a robot talking about it. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming you guys don't do any scripting over there. Or do you have a flow? How, you know, what is the, just in maybe a minute, what is the process?
For Corolla?
Yeah.
His interviews of people that we've booked, or the other way around?
The people that you guys have booked.
Okay. Well, for the people either. We've booked, it's I can talk about the other side too. It's a pretty simple process. We don't script it, is a short way of saying it. We give Adam some notes on who that person is, some notable things to, but literally bullet points, not here's what we should say about this project.
Right.
It's more like, here is this project. That's a thing worth talking about and asking about and all that. It's not scripted at all.
Yeah, because it just, to me, it's like, I don't even want to read the questions, because they send me these pre-listed questions. I don't even want to read them, because it's like, okay, then I'm overthinking how I'm going to answer the thing during the interview, and it drives me insane. But if you're doing a business show out there, just ask questions. Don't... scripted it. Let the conversation flow. All right, Rob. Swell. 30 million. Apple.
30 million. Yeah. That's like I was thinking about this the other day, and I guess that's like the go-to amount for a big company to buy a tech startup, right? I mean, how many tech startups have we heard that were bought for 30 million, right? It's
a
like
lot.
Every single one of them.
Is right? It you know, is it maybe the number the VC set because they X number of money and they've got to have an X time return?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's part of what it is. It's like most VCs will put in like, you know, $10 to $12 million, right? In you know, to get them up to like maybe a C round, maybe B round, and then you know, it's like a 2X return or whatever on the investment as like a baseline of what the but. But I think that the bigger conversation about Swell is more about, you know, why and what they had and what Apple's going to use it for, you know, or I don't know if you guys want to speculate that. I can talk about it too, but
I think it's my speculation is that they, you know, number one, they killed the app. That's gone.
Yeah, well, that tells you a lot right there.
So that's so there was, you know, and obviously, and so what was Swell's claim to fame? It was like, we're going to find the, you know, what you like, the discovery portion. And does that mean they're going to roll discovery into iTunes? I how come they couldn't roll that themselves at Apple? That's my question. Was the technology really that good? Or, and you know, they could have just went out and, are they hurting for employees that much? They had to do an acqui-hire? I'm not 100%.
I think that's exactly what it was. I think it was an acqui-hire.
But how many people were on the Swell team?
There was about 12.
30. It's a lot of money to spend for 12 employees.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm surprised because I don't know how this is going to play into Apple. Into Apple's overall business, because podcasting isn't a business for Apple. I mean, it's a marketing tool, is probably the best. And I'm guessing I don't have any real insights that other folks would have. But podcasting is literally a marketing tool. Like, oh, here's how easy we can or cannot make it for Apple people, whether it's your iPhone or whatever, to consume podcasts. I'm with you guys. Like, I guess acquiring talent, something that I wouldn't know for a company the scale of Apple's, what makes sense in terms of money. But in terms of product offering, you'd think that Apple would be able to build something like that very easy. It can't be that crazy of an algorithm. And I can't imagine spinning it into something that new other than maybe, you know, radio stations that are easy to discover. I'm trying to think of what makes sense for Apple. So I tend to agree with you guys about talent, but I think you two would know more about have better insights into how that works.
Or were they just looking to knock off the player? You know, were they just trying to eliminate another streaming player in the scene? You know, were they trying just, okay, let's get rid, you know, that's just going to be, you know, it's too many. Let's say it's 1% or even 0.5% of, you know, it's taking away from iTunes. Maybe that was the reason. You know, there's, well, who knows?
Yeah, I think Daniel J. Lewis raises a good point. And I think, his comment is that what Apple really acquired was a team that knows how to build, a smart back end that understands users' behavior. Apple is not really strong with those kind of machine learning technologies, and the team of Swell was comprised of PhD level technology talent around machine learning and learning about what users do from and taking various signals from social media platforms, from actual software usage, and projecting, taking that data and projecting back to the user recommendations and suggestions and other things based on their history. So you have this machine learning piece, which Apple isn't really all that strong at. So I think that was a big part of what was part of that deal, is that I think what they're trying maybe to create is a Pandora of sorts. Because if you think about it, a lot of what Pandora does is that same thing. It's a machine learning thing, though there's a lot of people behind Pandora too that are categorizing tracks and things like that. But I think it's a combination of podcasts, online radio, play here is why they bought Swell. It wasn't just about podcasting. And because I think that technology can be applied to their music store, and it could even be applied to their TV offering too. So I think it may be a much bigger play for them, but I think at the end of the day, it was around getting in some real talent in there that can help them elevate the experience in their client software.
I think you hit on something really important there, because I see it for, again, my other job, that my day job, that's more about social media than anything else. Learning from signals is becoming more and more important across every platform. Yep. And it is really the centerpiece of some of the biggest platforms out there, like Facebook. They want to learn from every signal that you, Rob, or you, Todd, are throwing out there to keep you on that platform for as long as possible and keep doing more Facebook things or things with Facebook business partners. And that is, you know, anecdotally, just looking at the ecosystem, that, and you see it for other, you see it for other platforms, the Google Pluses of the world, almost everything other than Twitter, which I'm assuming they're working on, you know, the new news feeds and Twitter, or timelines rather. But that's not something just looking around that you see a lot of in iTunes. iTunes isn't custom, or Apple in general. It doesn't realize, oh, Mike Chaffee, you like this better than that. Here's how I keep him on whatever device, platform, app that Apple owns a little bit longer, or sell me more TV shows. I have an Apple TV. You'd think it would know by now, like, oh, make sure that we're sending Mike Chaffee this type of thing, because he usually likes it. The batting average is a little higher. But I just don't see that. And on Facebook, you see it so much that it's a given. Like, most people don't even understand how much Facebook is judging every signal that you're putting into it, that it really keeps you on there for a lot longer.
I can't even tell you the last time I used my Apple TV. I'm on my Roku or my Amazon Fire TV. I live on those two devices. And, I mean, like, the only time I go on to Apple is make sure the show's still playing okay on the device. I just, it's kind of weird because it's lost a lot of relevancy for me because just it's so limited.
By the way, I agree, you know, not to speak about a device too much here, but I totally agree. I've got all the devices downstairs in the living room. And it's mostly just library content. The movies are already bought on Apple. You know, the 7-year-old likes all the Marvel movies we bought on it, so we play those on that.
Right.
But the centerpiece of the living room now, and I don't know whether Rob would like this or not, is our Xbox One. And that's been a little glitchy here and there, but we do the pass-through and all that. So that's the centerpiece right now.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I don't own an Xbox One, so I'm still living in the Xbox 360 world.
Yeah, you know, and I guess we'll see what happens.
Compact.
I guess we'll see what happens with Apple and the Apple TV and all this other stuff's going on with Discovery. I don't know. I hang around some folks from time to time, and they play Pandora and they're playing Playlist, and they're not necessarily kicking a genre and going with it. But you know, hey Rob, we're here already at the past the top of the hour, and we probably should let Mike go here. But any final questions for Mike before we let Mike go? Or
so when it, Mike? So when is podcasting gonna kill radio?
Well, I think that's and you hear the same thing about digital TV. When is YouTube gonna kill TV? I think that's the wrong way of viewing all of it. I think the two merge. I think it slowly, each becomes the other little by little. And you'll see, and you are seeing, you're seeing companies like Clear Channel do iHeartRadio and invest heavily in online and streaming, and maybe not so much on demand yet. Some of them are focusing on demand, but you're also seeing a lot of, right now, ancillary content. So it's not the most important feature from an entertainment company that's larger, a radio company, but you're seeing them invest in podcasting and looking at podcast stars and using that talent to create shows and to create either promotion, marketing, or an actual business. So I think you'll see it both ways. You'll see a lot of podcasters go to companies and help them figure out podcasting. And I think you'll see a lot of radio broadcasters turn to podcasting. I think you'll see a two-way street on that, and that both start learning and becoming the other more and more.
Do you think on the buzz, you know, it appears, at least to me, it seems like the buzz in the space is at an all-time high, as maybe not as compared to when we started, but right now the buzz is really through the roof. And I'm really excited about it. Do you think it's because of this transition that the buzz is like on its way up?
It's real buzz. That's why.
You know what? I don't think it's that transition, because I've seen that transition happen little by little, and it's slow. You know, a lot of these companies don't move really, really quick. They're huge entertainment companies or media companies. I think the buzz, and I could be way off the mark on this. This is my guess. I think the buzz is the new technologies that are coming out, the new solutions, the way that you cater to the audience in a different fashion. there are some big there are some big talents coming out in podcasting, and there's buzz around that. But maybe I'm too much of a nerd that likes all these apps and technology and all that. But I think that seems somewhat revolutionary in the past 2 years. Like all the different easier ways for people to consume this content. I think that's what's driving some of this buzz.
And I think just it's true too, the ease. You know, it's just click play. You know, that's really what it boils down to now too.
And I think that the radio folks are are seeing a steady decline in their overall numbers. It's not falling off the cliff by any stretch of the imagination, but it's still where the vast majority of the advertising budgets are still on broadcast radio. So I think that over time, I think what we're going to see is those, like Mike was just saying, that we're going to see these big media companies start to embrace podcasting more, move the direction, try and figure out this struggle that a lot of them have between local and national content, because a lot of them just are focused on local, you know, shows, right, that are in a particular market, and have a struggle to figure out, you know, how to make a show a national show. And, you know, I see it firsthand with what we're doing, because we try and work with, you know, syndicated shows that are in many markets, right? Because those are greater candidates for making an easier jump to podcasting. But a show that's only in Seattle or only in LA has a struggle to jump to podcasting. And a lot of the big radio networks are focused on that kind of content right now. So, you know, it's going to be a transition for them. And a weeding out, I believe, of what's going to happen. But still, for broadcast radio, local is still going to be important. So if there's going to be some way to do both, right, to still have local podcasts as well as national podcasts, I think that's where the future is. How long it's going to take for us to get there is a factor of audience growth. How many podcast listeners can we get, let's say, in Seattle? Right, that would listen to a local show as a podcast, and is that monetizable?
So. And another thing too is, you know, what I've seen this year, by far the most number of business phone calls we've had this year has been with terrestrial radio folks.
Yep,
and that's the podcasting community's kind of set. They kind of know where they're going. The biggest call out has been the terrestrial radio folks looking for help. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, and what's big different about terrestrial radio, they've got money to spend.
Yeah.
You know? So, and they understand the space is changing too, but it's amazing to me sometimes getting some of these program directors on the phone and, it's a,
yeah, I know those program directors. But by the way, it's funny because they're so behind, and I totally get what you're talking about. But in a weird way, as those guys become educated or their teams become educated, everything that comes with that comes to podcasting. Those relationships, those commercials, that everything, the talent.
Everything.
So it'll be good. It'll be good for the entire community.
I agree. And it's just a matter of education and getting them up to speed.
Yeah. Mike, so what's your thought on the whole local versus national with the big radio networks? I mean, how's that gonna play out, do you think?
Well, I would say before you think about the radio networks, think about the entire tech landscape of national versus local. You see companies like Google and Yelp and you know, all these companies kind of still struggling, doing a lot better than they were just years ago. With that sort of local, how are we making a business out of local? And they know it's a priority, I'm pretty sure. And you see it more and more in Google Maps and Yelp and everything else in your device. You know, maybe not the four squares of the world, but everything else in your device. You see those things getting better and becoming more of a real business. I think it's tougher for radio because it's not about the tech solution for radio and podcasting. I think it's about those relationships, what makes sense and how do you manage it? How do you have a body in Seattle talking to the community in Seattle about, hey, what's your business needs? How can we help you?
Right.
How can we charge you for that help in the right sort of way? I think it's that. It's creating that network of dialogues and people across the country that's going to be the much tougher thing than just serving ads to Seattle.
I think a lot of these program directors, though, and station heads are very excited about the ability to – take a local drive show that maybe is not, it is local, and having exposure nationwide. And again, that, of course, that oftentimes comes with, you know, ideas of, wow, we can go and, you know, and sometimes maybe they should stay focused locally. So I think a lot of these local radio stations are figuring out how they can make their drive shows national, which I don't know if it's a good thing or not, but.
Yeah, I was amazed. You know, we have the Dan Patrick Show on our platform, and Dan produces like 3 hours of sports talk every day, right? And he puts out three separate episodes every day of his show. And he's a tremendous success as a podcaster. And he really, that show flies in the face of conventional wisdom around podcasting, because that much content being put out, you would think would be just way too much for podcasting, right? I mean, what most of us think that, you know, I mean, even like what Adam is doing, putting out just one episode a day is a lot of content, you know, an hour and a half. But Dan's putting out like 3 hours, almost 3 hours a day, and he's getting people downloading all 3 hours. And I think one of the things that I kind of learned from him, he's like 15 hours of content a week. And what I've kind of learned from that is it's about, like we were talking about earlier, it's about engaged audiences. If you have a rabid fan base that loves your content, loves your personality, they'll take as much as you can give them. And yep. And if it makes sense for them to download it because it's unique and has an interesting guest on, and they're talking about fascinating stuff that you have an interest in, I mean, I think Adam could probably do 3 hours a day too and be highly successful. I don't know, Mike, what's your thought?
Oh, absolutely. And that's been, that was talked about early on, of doing literally our radio show, doing a 4 hour show. And at one point that obviously went away and other projects got mixed in, but he is creating nearly that scale of content when you consider all the shows Adam's doing. He's not doing it in the same fashion of the 4 hour radio show or 3 hours that Patrick is doing.
But they're different shows.
Yeah, I think Adam could do that, and I think it would be amazingly successful.
And I want to tame this conversation just a little bit for the rest of you out there. Doing that level requires an amazing amount of support. You're not going to do that by yourself.
No. You know,
you need...
This is not for mere mortals.
No.
without a production team, like, right, besides everything else, marketing and tech and all that, you filling 3 hours isn't as easy as Adam walking up to the mic. There's research notes. There's, hey, look at this picture. You do need producers to do stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's, you know, I think about the prep I do for my own show and then how long it takes me to produce the show and so forth. And 3 hours, you know, I know a couple of guys that do a 3 hour show and they only do twice a week because they need, you know, 3 or 4 days in between to collect 3 hours worth of material. So, but boy, to talk for 3 hours that's, you got to hand it to Dan Patrick. I don't know if I could talk about sports for 15 minutes, let alone 3 hours. So, whew. But you know, go ahead, Rob.
So we did launch with the Clark Howard podcast here recently, and he was doing 2 hours on a national syndicated show, and we basically rolled up the 2 hours into one episode for him. So it's like an hour and 15 minutes or something like that. So it was a little bit, I mean, I think each of these, you know, big radio talkers, you can approach it differently depending on, you know, how much content they're producing and stuff. And it's an interesting, you know, I'm learning a lot from it because we're trying to plow that ground between broadcast and podcasting, right? And but that blade cuts both directions. So, you know, you have to be very careful, you know, you don't damage the show on the podcasting side, and they're obviously not going to change the format on the broadcast side necessarily. And I think that's another big question too, is that I think as this convergence happens, is that going to force the broadcast formats to change? I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
Well, we're already doing it. How have you watched, Rob, any TV during prime time that wasn't already DVR'd? Do you watch anything where you have to sit through the commercials?
Rarely.
I haven't in years.
Rarely.
You know, everything is on the DVR. And what do? I don't even know what's being advertised on. I see it in fast forward. Whoa. It goes through. So if I'm doing it and the rest of the cable, everyone else that has a DVR in their house is doing it, why are they still making money digital on advertising? There's got to be someone that's like watching that stuff and reacting. Maybe not, you know, but it's a little harder to, where's my iPad at? Where's my iPhone? Let me fast forward to, you know, it's a little harder to fast forward. So just from a pure advertising standpoint, I think it's got to shift.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
I think the advertising, you know, and we could probably talk ad nauseum about all this stuff. I know what you mean. I think we're probably a different, no pun intended. we're probably a different type of beast in terms of how the three of us consume content than your average person across America. Even though I am a nerd through and through, I still watch sports, and they're getting their pound of flesh with all the commercials I'm seeing whenever I watch sports. And I think there is going to be more work on the product offering in broadcast in terms of how you deliver ads. And I think you see it, you know, if you watch American Idol, you're going to see integrations that you don't even consider integrations. And by integrations, I mean advertisements, the Coke on the desk, the bumpers out that mention whatever brand. I think you're seeing that. You're seeing that shift. But I think there's exactly right. So I don't know. I think that's going to happen slower than a lot of people think it's going to happen, because we really are a different breed than most of the people consuming content.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've seen some really, really interesting ad formats on the Jimmy Kimmel Live show. You know, they'll do these like that. These skits and stuff like that. Mike, have you noticed that too?
I just noticed that they're great ads every time.
But at the same time, you know, there's some stuff that morphs into, was that an ad or was that just part of the thing? And so the FCC is definitely going to be watching all of us to make sure that we disclose that if I'm twirling some chapstick in my hand, that there's some sort of a credit for chapstick that's in the credits or some sort of a, you know, disclosure. But
promotional messaging provided by.
Right.
Yeah.
I wish we were at that point where I could just twizzle a chapstick thing in my hand and get paid for it. That's when we've hit the big time.
Well, you know, that's probably possible.
Consider the real human element behind that of, hey, you're biz dev, you're ad dude, you're Don Draper saying, hey, listen, Madison Avenue, Todd's going to be flipping around this chapstick today. How much is that worth to you?
That's right.
And then they're going to have to leverage it. They're going to, like, there's a huge element to, there's a huge human element to that, that people, I don't think consider too much.
Or better yet, I go ahead and use it during the show. Yeah. Sorry, folks. My lips are a little dry.
That's worth more. You know, how much is it worth to you, chapstick?
Well, you know, I mean, we're probably not that far away from that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think so,
because
too.
You know, with the visual recognition, you know, which also has a connection to Swell too. The guy that created Swell created the algorithm to scan visual imaging to find things for Amazon, and it's being used in Facebook and that kind of stuff too. Or, I mean, I can see that, right? I mean,
yeah.
Why couldn't there be something like that, right? That there's some way for some ad network to pick that up and give you credit for that.
Before I started wearing glasses, which actually had a prescription attached to them, I was a big fan of Gunner's glasses. And I was wearing Gunner on the show for a while. And I kept saying, man, it would be great if Gunner did a sponsorship deal. And I tried to work that hard, that endorsement of just nothing but wearing the Gunner glasses and mentioning it during the show. But they weren't, I don't think they had enough money at the time to even consider advertising, but you know, I definitely tried it before, but maybe its time has come. Maybe we should all start, you know, anything is, you know, then people are gonna be like, okay, are you selling to me all the time? You know, that's the challenge you have too.
Hey guys, between all three of us, we could start a new company. You know, we could we could start a startup, right? Just doing that. No, just
yeah, kidding. I'm sure it is.
I mean, the shirt we're wearing could literally one day be a banner ad in the video of, hey, buy this shirt. And without any, without lifting a finger from any human element. And that's when the game changes in a huge way. Yes, but for now, it's still, it's, you still got to call up Madison Avenue and ask for some money.
And the way it's being done now is the guy goes, go over to my cafe press store and pick up one of my shirts. That's how it's being done now. That's how some guys are monetizing. And it's, you know, I don't know with what success, but.
So I also wanted to mention Mike's going to be joining us at our on our panel at the Podcast Movement.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. We get to talk about podcast networks.
We're going to talk about podcast networks, whether or not to be involved in one or what's the best approach for either joining one or not joining one. So I'm excited to, or starting one. So I'm excited to have him join us. I think he brings a unique perspective to building a podcast network since he's done it.
So do you think, are we going to have an opponent on there? Are we going to have someone that's vehemently against starting a podcast network? Or am I going to have to play devil's advocate and be the bad guy?
I think we should all be the devil's advocate on that. Yeah. Because, I mean, I think it is true that not every podcaster, and I'm not going to give away the boat here, but I don't think every podcaster needs to be part of a network.
Right.
That's kind of. I think
you're right. We should set up a very adversarial. Somebody's got to walk out with a championship belt high above their head, and somebody else has got to try to attack. No, I think that's the approach. I'll make for a fun panel.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, because I mean, I think all of us have been on that side. I mean, I haven't been a part of a network with always with the show. And I know Todd.
I can tell you all about the good, bad, and ugly of building a network. I can tell you about the negatives real easy.
Oh yeah.
I think all of us have been on both sides of the coin to a certain extent. Yeah. I mean, both personal projects and business projects. I've got thoughts on both sides, on all three of those, starting, building, or not joining. Yeah.
And I think, I think we're going to bring some perspectives on the keys to actually having a successful network too. I think that's going to be important. Yeah.
I mean, it's been a little bit of a controversial topic, you know, that's popped up in the community, and there's a lot of folks that, you know, say go independent, you know, own everything end to end, and that kind of stuff. So we'll cover all that kind of stuff too.
And I will say that we did confirm that, Marshall Williams and one of his team members from Ads Results Incorporated is going to be there for my panel on Saturday talking about Meet the Media Buyer. So Marshall and his team have been buying a lot of podcast advertising and look forward to introducing him and letting the audience essentially have some questions. And we're going to talk about, you know, when you should have advertising, what it takes, what they expect, the money, all that stuff that, you know, I think this is going to be one of the first opportunities that many podcasters will have to actually talk to, you know, the guy that signs the insertion order for a deal. And I think it's going to be a great panel. So I'm looking forward to that one too on Saturday.
So are you going to ask him to be on this show at some point?
Probably after the event, I'll try to have him on. Sure. Yeah. I want to save the juicy stuff for the panel and make sure everyone, you know, I want to give people an opportunity to, you know, if someone's thinking about this space as a business, I think that panel alone is going to be worth the price of admission, and the trial. And I'm being very, you know, obviously self-centered here, but I think it's going to be a great discussion. And we're going to be very bluntly honest with some folks because not everyone should have advertising on their shows and why. So we're actually meeting next week to talk about the structure of it, but I think it's going to be good.
Well, I think it's great that you found one that was willing to come out publicly because I think, I mean, a lot of them can be kind of protective of their strategies and their approaches.
And yeah. I don't know how much they will share with, you know, we'll have to, you know, take that, but I'm sure people are going to be asking, and I want to spend a little time talking and a lot of time allowing people to ask questions, because I know the answers already, but I want people to get the, you know, that direct back and forth. I think that's the important thing. Don't hear it from me, hear it from the horse's mouth.
Yep.
So, but it'll be fun. And if any of you that are listening to the show are not coming to Podcast Movement, this is the only podcasting event this year. You need to really think about coming to Dallas and hanging out that weekend. I think it's going to be a great time. I think it's going to have a good vibe. It's an inaugural event, and we're still waiting on, I know Rick had sent me an email. I was meant to meet with Rick from New Media Expo this week, but kind of ran out of time. But I know that they have something soon they're going to announce. So maybe we'll know what's going to happen for 2015 and the timeline for hopefully a show in Vegas. So we'll see.
Yeah, I'm excited to actually hear what that's going to be. I'm kind of anticipating what it's going to be, but it's going to be great to have two events, you know?
Yeah, I think so too. And,
yep.
But we'll see what happens at this event. Hopefully we all, I hope we see a lot of new faces. That's the goal. I want to meet 500 new people at the show that we've never seen before. So anyway, I encourage you guys to come out to it. It's podcastmovement.com.
Yep.
If nothing else, let's have a beer. You know, hang out. That'll be the fun part, right?
I'll look forward to that for sure.
Yeah.
Should we have a new media show meetup or something?
You know what, Rob? I don't know. They've got it pretty well scheduled where there's lots of stuff going on in the evening. So, maybe we can find really a new media show corner or something. And corner.
Stool at the far end of the bar.
Yeah.
Whatever that is, right?
Right at the bar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've taken this all the way to the end. So, Mike,
we did.
Yeah, thanks for hanging with us and chatting. It's been great.
Hey, thank you for having me. I always like chatting and looking forward to speaking with you guys in Dallas.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. Yep. And a lot of great people are coming. I know some of the people are in the chat room are going to be there. Dan J. Lewis is going to be there. And I think there was a couple other folks in the chat room earlier that'll be there as well. So,
Dave Jackson was in there for a while.
Yeah.
Yep.
And those of you that are on YouTube watching, I know we've got pretty good numbers today. Thanks for being here and watching the show. We are making progress. The newmediashow.com website will at some point soon be up. I'm riding herd on my web developer in a big way, but we've had a few things pop up that have delayed the template, and it's largely, I can't speak about it, but it is for a good reason. At some point, maybe I'll be able to share. But otherwise, we are at some point going to make the rollover to the new site design. But for now, just come over to geeknesscentral.com or even newmediashow.com, redirects to the right page. And then if you want to reach out to Rob or I, you can do that at todd@newmediashow.com or rob@newmediashow.com. We want to hear your comments, thoughts, who we should have on, someone, if you got someone that's big in the space that you want to hear, or even someone you think's doing something innovative, give us an idea. We're always looking to build the guest list. And do you have anything on tap for next week, Rob, yet, or are we?
I don't have anybody that I can announce right now, but I'm definitely thinking out of the box on this one for the next episode. It may be a female, so we'll see.
That's even better.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I like to mix it up a little bit here. I think, we need to get more women podcasters into the space. I've felt that way for years and years.
I agree.
Todd, can you tell us kind of what's going to be new about the new template and the new website for the show? What kind of capabilities are going to be there that we didn't have before?
Number one, it's going to have its own page. It's going to be its own. It's going to be its own domain. You're going to, the live stuff is going to be right on that web page directly. All the newest episodes will obviously be at the very top of the page. We're going to have the cross promotion with the other shows on the site as well. But the main thing is much, much easier to, you're going to land on the website. There's going to be no reason not to click play. It's also going to be mobile ready. So it's the design, I forget what they call it, but as the site.
Responsive design.
Design. The site will be completely responsive. Yep. And I think that's the most important part of the big change. And a new template, fresh look. And actually, what we're going to be doing is this template, We may even make the template available to podcasters at some point. We may. This is going to be something that is initiative by Raw Voice, and it's part of an initiative for us to come up with two or three great templates that podcasters can use. And it's going to be a kind of a build in progress. We're going to do the top and bottom and work on the middle and tweak it, and then maybe even release the template code to the community at large. So that's what's forthcoming with the new template design.
I'll throw this out there. Responsive is one of the biggest buzzwords I've heard in the past like 3 months. Every other meeting I've taken, it's been responsive this, responsive that.
Well, if you look at here's the reason why it's cool, because it's kind of a poor man's way of getting a podcast app. and if you look, and everyone knows how this works, at least I think everyone does. See, you can squeeze it, and then it shrinks, and it's able to handle the different sizes of the web page you're on.
It shrinks and reorganizes if needed.
Right.
Which is the truly responsive part.
Yeah. And it ends up being in a cool stack here. So it doesn't matter if you come in with a mobile phone, it's going to kind of look like that, And the plan will obviously be, if the responsive design, what will be at the top is the player of the latest episode. And
though I would have to say that as you look into the very near future and a lot of the phones, the smartphones that are out there now, they don't need to be responsive design
because
they're 1080p screens. They got almost as much resolution as my 24-inch monitor here. So, the whole thing with responsive design is really kind of interesting. I don't know that it's a huge improvement, but I think it's kind of a transitionary thing. I don't know. I mean, I'm a little bit on the fence about it. I think it's good overall, but I think the devices that we're starting to move into don't really need it sometimes. So anyway.
But I think too is sometimes it's easier to just scroll up and then
it
instead
is.
Of having to sure. zoom and do all the stuff that's normally
yeah.
done.
Yeah, no, I agree with you.
Yeah. All right, that's going to make it a wrap for us here at the New Media Show, and we look forward to being back with you next week. We'll have an announcement on Twitter when we're ready. Of course, you can follow myself at Geek News or Rob at Rob Greenlee. Of course, Mike, we've had your stuff up periodically as well, but let me put the lower third up. It's at CIOFFI. Yeah,
Chaffee. Mr. Chaffee. Just call him Mr. Chaffee.
Yes, absolutely.
Chaffee works better than Mike. There's so many Mikes. There's not too many Chaffees.
Well, say hello to Adam and the team and Maddie over there and everyone, and look forward to talking to you soon, Mike. Thanks so much.
Good times. Thank you, man.
Hey, take care.
Thanks.
And everyone,
Thanks, Mike.
We'll see you next time. Aloha.